Hi, Stuart. Welcome back on AirHacks FM podcast.
Hi, Adam. Good to be back. Thanks for inviting me back on.
And we have some exciting news to share. So I got an email. So by the way, we are the best prepared guest on the show.
What makes you say that?
Yeah, because I received an email from you with, you know, some feedback to recent episodes and with some pointers to episode with Morris. But the exciting news are what you told me is that there will be a new JAP which will integrate a teletype, a model 33 with Java, right? So we could very easily create punch cards with Java 28.
Yeah, maybe. Actually, the teletype model 33, there is a connection between previous topics from them to this, but the teletype model 33 didn't have punched cards; it had punched paper tape.
Ah, okay. So. You see, yeah. I mean, this JAP is in the making. We cannot be. This is not released yet. This is a preview, right? So
it might be an incubating JAP. It might be incubating for a very long time.
Mm-hmm. This could be a good joke, maybe, actually, right?
Yeah. Maybe announce it on April 1st or something.
Yeah.
Like that.
But what's interesting is what you wrote is that this TTY comes from the name of the company, right?
Right. Yeah. So there was a company called Teletype, mm-hmm. and that's kind of what they did. You could hook one of these up to the phone line to another Teletype or to a computer, mm-hmm. and you could type on it, and what you typed was transmitted over a 110 baud modem, which is about 10 characters per second, mm-hmm. To the other end. And so, yeah, that was the original, the original, the way we got on this topic was in a previous episode, Morris Naftalin mentioned using punched paper tape, and he didn't know how he used it, but I used to use it. And so that's how this teletype comes in, because it had a punched paper tape punch and reader. Mm-hmm. And so that's how people in the days, this, I guess, I don't know when this started, 1960s maybe, or maybe 1950s. But in those days, you could make long distance phone calls, but they were very expensive, like several dollars per minute. Mm-hmm. And so if you wanted to transmit written information very quickly, then the teletype machine would help you do that. And it ran over a service called Telex. So it could either run over private phone lines or over the public phone lines. But basically what you did is you offline, you typed your message and punched it to paper tape. Mm-hmm. And then you made the very expensive phone call and then read the paper tape in that you just punched. And that typed it at 10 characters per second, which is faster than, I mean, it's not, it's faster than most people can type. Not everybody.
It's like ChatGPT, right? This is also similar.
Yeah, kind of. But, you know, something like that. You can kind of see the characters appearing, right?
Yeah, exactly.
It was very noisy because it was an electric typewriter.
Yeah, but maybe, you know, this OpenAI is working on a new teletype, you know? This is why to make it faster. Right. This is why they need so much resources.
Teletype interface to AI, yeah. So anyway, yes.
I opened the Teletype Model 33 Wikipedia link, which I'll put to the show notes, and the machine looks actually surprising, like a, yeah, like a writing machine, right? And what I read is there were 500,000 made in 1975. So it was
1975. Yeah. Okay. Yeah, I guess so. That was just before faxes started becoming really popular. But yeah, so if you wanted to send written communication in real time to somebody else who had a teletype machine, you could do that. And it would only take, you know, it was relatively inexpensive, right? So if you picked up the phone and talked to somebody, you know, if you spend a couple minutes on the phone, that's, you know, dollars, $10, $20. I made a call to Europe once to arrange some hotel reservations, and it was $50 to make the phone call.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Right? I mean, it's ridiculous. Mm-hmm. So if you could type out your message, you could use punch paper tape to type it very fast, and you'd only be on the expensive long distance call for a minute or two.
Yeah, so, assuming that 10 characters per second are faster than your because you are paying for the same line, right? So you're paying for time regardless.
You're paying for time. Yes, exactly. Not the number of characters. Yeah.
So you are saying that 10 characters per second was substantially faster than a human could speak, right? Or more efficient, not faster, because it's going back and forth. You have to say, you know, whatever you have to say.
Yeah. You know, you pick up the phone and you say, "Hi, Adam, how are you? How's the weather in Germany?" You know, I mean,
why German never say that, right? What's going on? And come on, right? So
let's
is like,
started. Okay, yeah, I'll get started. Press the record button.
Yeah, exactly. But this is actually cool. But I remember, I think I saw such machines. And I saw the telex. They were in the post offices. Is it possible?
I think so. I mean,
because I remember the name telex.
Yeah, it's well, I assume that was in Germany.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So in Germany, I mean, my recollection of this is not very good, and I'm. Mm-hmm. But I think the post office ran all the phone lines as well, and so in Germany, and so there was a lot more public services provided by the Deutsche Post.
Mm-hmm.
So it wouldn't surprise me at all if there was, you know, a service they provided where you could write out a message and they would send it to somebody via telex.
Mm-hmm.
And that makes sense.
Whereas, do you know the American movie Three Amigos with Chevy Chase?
Yes, Chevy Chase and Steve Martin and Martin Short, I think.
And they sent a message at the beginning of the movie, and it was too expensive, so they had to shorten the message. And I think this was a telex.
Well, I don't remember what era that was set in, but it was like horseback riding, if I'm not mistaken. So that might have been telegram.
Telegram, okay. Okay,
so telegram. Telegram is even like Morse code and stuff like that.
Yeah, I think it could be Morse code. I forgot that this was a long time ago.
Uh-huh. Yeah, so that was earlier. And so the thing about telex was that in a small office, everybody had phone lines. And, you know, one of these machines was not terribly expensive, but you could install them in small offices. Like, so I remember
$1,000.
Okay, yeah. In a previous episode, we talked about my father's history working for Wang Laboratories. Mm-hmm. So that's where I saw a telex machine.
Mm-hmm.
And they connected all of the field offices for the company via telex. And they could send messages back and forth that way. Mm-hmm. So internal corporate announcements were sent that way.
So telex is similar to modems, right?
Well, they transmitted characters over phone lines using modems.
Yeah.
And so... so it was 110 baud, and remember the most recent modems before they became obsolete was, I think, 56 kilobaud, I think something like that.
56,
right?
64, so, maybe, but it was already ISDN, I think. I had the robotics, 33.6, I think this was already fast, and 55 was compression, whatever they were. Some,
right, so that's pretty amazing. So you think about that, and that's you know, 400 times faster or something like that.
Mm-hmm. Crazy. So because you prepared already so well, I think we should start with Lambda from the core of Java 8 and Lambda streams, right? So this would be the chronological order.
We could, yeah. So to pick up where we left off with a previous episode, I think I had finished off Java 7. Yeah, so Java 8, that was... Well, I mean, what is there to say about it? it was kind of, I mean, yeah. So the big feature that everybody remembers from Java 8 was Lambda and streams.
Mm-hmm.
No question about that. I think the other thing that people forget, but which is equally, if not more important, is default methods, which was the ability to evolve, basically provided the ability to evolve an interface.
But you needed this for streams to make all collections compatible, right, with the earlier
So we could have gotten away without it, but I think it was one of those things that it made the APIs a lot nicer. And so I think the idea of streams in Lambda stands on its own, right? So you can, you know, suppose you had created a stream from somewhere and you could chain things to it and you could, like, filter, map, you know, flat map, that sort of thing, and you could use lambdas to plug functions into those methods, and that all works great. The question is how you create streams, and so you could certainly have a bunch of utility methods that you could have like a static utility method that you could say, you know, create me a stream from a collection. And probably under the covers, what it would do would be to take an iterator, do some things, and turn the iterator into a stream. And that would work, but there would be a couple of problems with it. One is that since the main way to get elements out of a collection is with an iterator, an iterator presents elements only one at a time. And so it makes it really difficult to run streams in parallel. So remember, that was one of the big deals about streams was to be able to run in parallel. And so the in object systems, the way to specify an interface, but let the implementer provide an optimized implementation that is tailored towards the implementation is to have an instance method. And then you can the implementer can override that. And so you can see that you see that all over the place in Java. I mean, that's such an obvious thing, but it bears repeating. And that's why so that was the problem, which is it's still the case. You can take any collection, turn it into an iterator, and then turn it into a splitterator, and then turn it into a stream. But basically you're really forced into processing the elements one at a time. And it would be really hard to recover any parallelism from that. But if you're able to override the stream creation method in a particular collections implementation, then the collection implementation can provide its own way of saying, oh, well, if we want to run things in parallel, then I have access to all the elements. And so I can split them up and present them to an arbitrary number of threads. And that's how we get parallelism. And so what I just described was the action of a splitterator. But in order, and so most of the collections implement their own splitterators. And so the typical thing is an array list. So an array list stores.
You came up with the name splitterator?
Oh, no. That was Brian Goetz. Oh,
okay.
Yeah, Brian was the main mover behind this. I mean, my contribution was to try stuff out and do investigations and make comments on the API. I mean, there were a bunch of interesting design decisions that we confronted early on. So I think we went back and forth because we wanted, well, it started off by saying, well, let's take the iterator concept and expand it so that it is splittable instead of one at a time. So we had a splittable iterator. And then from there was sort of a split, that kind of turned into a splitterator. One of the things we realized early on was that this would not work at all unless we were able to add methods to interfaces. And then so this has been a long-standing problem with Java up until Java 8. So if you had an interface and somebody implemented it, the requirement was to implement all the methods. Great. And suppose you came along later and said, I want to add a method to this interface. You could do that, but the problem is there might be all kinds of implementations of that. There might be many classes out there that implemented that interface, and they wouldn't have an implementation of that new method. And so if an application called it, they would get a no such method error or something like that. Linkage error of some sort. I actually forget what would happen. So basically the rule was established very early on in Java object design, which was once you've created and published an interface for people to implement with their classes, you cannot change it. And of course, object systems need to evolve. Over time, you discover the need for new things. You need to discover new techniques, better ways to express things. And so various systems worked around this issue by saying, well, I have a foo interface, but I need to extend it. I would add a method. So I'll extend the foo interface and I'll create a new interface, foo2, that extends foo, and then add new methods there. And then later on, I need more new methods. So I'll create a foo3 that extends foo2 and so forth. And so there are some systems that evolve their interfaces that way, which is a real pain because you can't just pass around a foo and call new methods on it. So anyway, So this is all lead up to, you know, in designing the streams and, you know, streams API and its infrastructure like Splitterators, it very quickly turned into a requirement that we would need to find a way to extend interfaces compatibly. Mm-hmm. And that's what default methods provide.
Yeah. And this was big deal back then. Hmm? I remember at all yes. Java ones, there were discussions, you know, how to do that, lots of criticism, discussions. The community, there was Java.net still around and Java blocks and Java world. Yeah. And everyone talked about default methods. And then, of course, what's the difference between interface and abstract class? You know, then this is...
right.
This was the common discussion back then. Yeah. Also the syntax of Lambda. And I think Java was a little bit under pressure because back then C# introduced Link and they were earlier than yes. Java and yes. very popular. And now no one talks about it anymore, I would say. It's just like it's just a, or it's just, you know, normal. And this is why everyone said, okay, we need it in Java streams. And because C# has Link. This was a language integrated query, which is similar right. to streams, right?
Yeah. Well, it turns out there were a bunch of things all going on at the same time. And I think the idea of extending Iterator to mm-hmm. to do more things was certainly fairly common knowledge. Now, here I'll give a shout out to my friend Don Robb, who is one of the original authors and maintainers of what is now Eclipse Collections. Mm-hmm. But before that, it was called GS Collections when it was at Goldman Sachs. And then before that, it was an internal project called Caramel. And so he was on the Lambda expert group. Mm-hmm. And so there was a lot of influence from his thinking. And so you can still see that in Eclipse Collections today. Mm-hmm. So what Eclipse Collections did was they built out their... basically streams gives you higher order functions like map, filter, reduce, mm-hmm. that kind of stuff. And so what Eclipse Collections did was they took the iterator concept, right? And well, you have an iterator, but a thing from which you can get an iterator is an iterable. Mm-hmm. And they chose that as their extension point. And so the primary interface in Eclipse Collections is called Rich Iterable. And so Rich Iterable extends the JDK iterable, mm-hmm. but it provides dozens of new higher order methods. Mm-hmm. And so it's sort of functionally equivalent to streams. But it has, you know, many, many more functions. So
probably yes. dig up and the interesting part is that Iterator came actually late. At the beginning, we had enumerations, right?
Oh, well, so now you're bouncing around in time. Yes. So in JDK 1.0, there was enumeration.
Exactly.
Yeah. Iterator came along with the original collections framework in mm-hmm. 1.2. Mm-hmm. So that was, I mean, it did come somewhat later, but that was very early on. Mm-hmm.
The enumeration had has more elements and elements, next element. Right. And there was a naming and string tokenizer, of course, used enumerations. I used this a lot. Yeah, this is what I remember. So this is I used the enumerations all the time. And in JDK 1.3, there was a naming enumeration introduced. It was interesting. But I also remember, you know, the enumeration and then the introduction of iterator and iterable. Because there was a bigger deal, because we used already enumeration in project, and then iterators were on the horizon,
right?
And they were similar. So the enumeration has more elements, and next element, and the iterator was a little bit shorter. So there was like next and has next or something, right?
Right. Mm-hmm. I am not entirely sure. I do not think. Actually, I should be able to call this up pretty quick. I think iterable didn't come until several releases later.
Yeah.
And the reason there was that iterable is the thing that was introduced in order to support the for each loop in Java 5. Mm-hmm.
So iterable was JDK 1.5.
Yep.
Very late. But the enumeration worked basically just with vector, I think. String tokenizer and I guess hash table, right? You were just, I assume. Because back then there were no collections.
Right. Well, yeah, there were what we call the legacy collections. Which
was thread safe, which are great. So hash table is thread safe and vector is thread safe. So if you use them, no problems.
Yeah.
And you could, you could even use virtual threads with hash table and vectors right now because there's no more pinning, right?
I suppose so, yeah.
So it means JDK 1.0 project can now migrate to JDK 25 and use virtual threads without any performance penalties, right?
maybe. Yeah, we'll see.
Maybe.
Well, anyway, but the thing about them being, I mean, certainly people took advantage of them being thread safe, but here's a bit of trivia, which is the problem is, I don't know if we talked about this in a previous one, but the problem is that providing thread safety at the method level for vector and hash table, or hashtable, as many of us call it, is at the wrong level, because usually you want to do more like atomic transactions on things. And so, but the other thing is that I think there was this idea that, well, the JIT compiler should be able to, or the JVM should be able to remove the overhead of synchronization. And it turns out that in the general case, that's not actually true. And so if you're not using, you definitely notice the overhead of using vector versus, say, array list in a single-threaded environment.
Yeah, because the entire, if you access, you know, individual elements, basically the entire thing is locked. The entire container is synchronized, right? That's the problem. I'm just looking at the vector because I was curious about the enumeration, the relation between vector and enumeration. And it seems like it is not directly implemented. So it seems like maybe collection implements enumeration, you know? So
I don't know. Okay, so now we're
you remember the teletype and you cannot remember the enumeration.
Okay, that was actually before I started to work on the JDK. So, all right. Well, one thing I do, and you can't see this, our listeners can't see it, but I have all of the old versions of Javadoc on my laptop, and so I can get to them at a moment's notice.
Hey, cool.
And, oh, right. Of course, there was. Okay. What was it? Elements.
Elements.
Yeah, so vector.elements returned an enumeration, but there's no interface that says this is a thing that can give you an enumeration. There's no enumerable, as it were.
Exactly. Because I search where elements comes from, and this is just a method. There is no interface which defines elements. Yeah, okay. So in the very, very beginning of Java, so we had vector.elements, and you get the enumeration back, and enumeration was similar, if not almost identical to iterator, I would say, right? So it's interesting why you had to rename that. This would also interest you. Remember? You could just reuse because it is similar somehow. It is has more elements. It has next element and as iterator. So there is, of course, this came later. I has to.
Yeah.
Has more elements and next element, two methods, and an iterator. Maybe because it was not generic. An iterator has next and remove and for each remaining.
So so remember, all of this stuff was introduced in JDK 1.2 with the original collections framework, and so there were no generics then. But yeah, I think that the part of it was I don't know all of the reasons Josh Block introduced iterator as an interface. I think part of the reason is that iterator is actually a fairly reasonably well-known term of art in computer science in language constructs. So having an iterator. So I had heard of iterators before I started working on Java because other languages had them. And so that's one thing. And then for some odd but pragmatic reasons, he also decided that that iterator would need to have a remove method, which is rather strange, but it it kind of makes sense, because the main use case there is, suppose you want to go through all the elements of a map. Mm-hmm. And now this is basic collection stuff in 1.2. So, and remember, so the programming style at that time was to mutate things in place. Mm-hmm. So suppose you had a map with a bunch of entries in it, key value pairs, and you wanted to, look at all the entries in a map and remove the ones that were no longer necessary. How would you do that? Well, and so basically the original collections way of doing this was to use is to get the map's entry set and get an iterator from that. And so now you get map entries, mm-hmm. which are key value pairs. And you can look at the key and the value and say, oh yeah, I don't need this anymore. And then you call a remove on the iterator to get rid of it.
Yeah.
So that's what it was there for. Although it does stick out because it's very strange, because most of the time, you know, when you iterate, you just want to read the elements. So it's very strange to have remove in there.
Nowadays, we would filter and create new list without.
Yeah, exactly. Usually, you run it through a stream and filter out the things you're not interested in. Mm-hmm.
That's is even an interesting thing called primitive iterator. Now you're surprised, huh?
Primitive. Actually, it's actually kind of interesting. Is that in JDK 8?
Yeah, 1.8. It was introduced, primitive iterator of n.
Yeah, mm-hmm. it's a little weird because those are actually not used anywhere, and if I'm not mistaken, those can't actually be used effectively anywhere. I think it's kind of interesting. I think they're leftovers from.
But because it's interesting, there's default method for each remaining where you can put int consumer, so you could maybe even pass, with indirectly system current time millis or something. So you would end up having an endless, almost like a stream. Mm-hmm. Uh-huh. So I will look at this because it looks interesting. This is like primitive iterator dot of int, and then you get an int iterator. But what we covered.
Mm-hmm. Oh well, so I was going to say this is okay. So one of the issues with streams was it's very easy to talk about. So we'll return back to Java 8, right? So we talked about default methods, mm-hmm. and so the idea was that we needed to go around and add the ability to create streams from a bunch of existing classes, mm-hmm. mostly collections, but not always. I mean, mm-hmm. there were several other places in the libraries where we wanted to create streams. But the main thing was collections, because if you had a bunch of elements in a collection, you wanted to stream them. So mm-hmm. so that was the primary use case for default methods. Okay, so that's great because collections can contain objects. And,
because you needed the default method to add the stream method without breaking the old ones, right?
That's right.
Mm-hmm. This was the use case. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And so that was great. That works fine for objects. And so we have collection. We have a collection of E, which is mm-hmm. generic, the generic type variable. And so generics at the time, and in fact, it is still the case that generics must be of reference type. So they're all objects. Mm-hmm. You cannot have generics over primitives. Mm-hmm. And so one of the compromises at the time, I mean, it basically harks back to the original compromise made in Java, which was to instead of having a pure object-oriented model, mm-hmm. Java 1.0 introduced this notion of primitives. Mm-hmm. And the reason for that is the original team did not believe they could make the system go fast enough if things like int were actually objects. Mm-hmm. And of course the Smalltalk guys say, oh, blah, 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 in Smalltalk, integer is an object and so forth. And there are many, many arguments about that. But the original Java designers said, in order to make this work, and in order to have arrays of them and to treat like a byte array as if it were straight memory, we really need to have primitives. Mm-hmm. So they made that decision very, very early on. I don't know who made that decision. That was probably it was certainly a James Gosling era mm-hmm. decision. Okay. So the object model we have has, there's Java Lang object and the hierarchy under that, plus there are the eight primitives. Mm-hmm. Okay. So when we introduced streams, we knew that people would want to operate on streams over essentially primitive data, but we didn't want to add 8 variations of streams. And so there's this compromise, which was, okay, what are the most useful primitives that people will likely want to use with streams? And so the 3 of the 8 primitives were chosen: int, long, and double. And so that's why you so not only is there, you know, Java util stream dot stream of t, but there's also int stream, long stream, and double stream. And we got on this topic because you noticed primitive iterator. And so there's primitive iterator of integer or of int, of long, of double. And those were added as part of the same stuff. But it turns out that I think those, I'm not entirely sure. I did an exploration of those and it's like, oh, you ought to be able to do something really cool with the primitive iterators. But it turns out you can't. And I'm not sure why. I think they're I think we added them in anticipation of, since we had needed, we call these primitive specializations of stream, in stream, long stream, double stream. So as soon as we added those primitive specializations, we also needed primitive specializations of splitterator. We also need primitive special, and we, I think the, I wasn't part of this effort, but whoever added those also probably said, we probably also need primitive specializations of iterator. And so that's where those came from. And I think they might be used in a little corner of the API somewhere, but in general, I don't think I've ever seen any code that actually uses them.
So I'm a bit disappointed because we are talking about 3 useless classes and you are not excited, you know? So usually you would say, I will immediately deprecate them and the next Java one, I will delete them, you know? This would be the perfect case for you.
Yeah.
Because we are talking here with, or I'm speaking here with Dr. Deprecator, Mr. Deprecator.
This is true. This is true.
But they,
actually, that's interesting.
They could be the candidates, right?
Of deprecation. Maybe. I'm clicking around the interface here. The problem is that if they're used in APIs, then... yeah, the problem is if they're using APIs, then it's hard to deprecate something because that means that you have to go around and deprecate the methods that return them. And so for instance, you can get a primitive iterator dot of double from a splitterator dot of double. And you can get a splitterator of double from a double stream. So, you know, you start pulling. So they are hooked into the APIs, but in practice, I think they're not useful. But deprecating it was difficult because it means we have to actually remove more stuff from the APIs. And sorry to disappoint you.
No, I thought, you know, you will, so like a smooth deprecation procedure, you know, like just.
Occasionally there is something that is completely useless that crept into the API by mistake and we just get rid of those. But no, these have dependencies on the rest of the APIs. So
this is a good news because it is hard to find useless stuff in Java, right?
Yeah.
So, I mean, if we will scan other languages, maybe, you know, we could immediately remove 50%, but in Java, everything is useful. What's inside? Just
maybe.
Joking. Maybe. But interesting part. So if we had enumeration and enumeration works in a for loop, more or less, iterator, because of iterable, we have the for each loop, but you are still looping. And streams are different. So in streams, there is no loop. You're just saying what you would like to do, and magic happens behind the scenes. And this is why if you say map and then filter, and at the end is, so I think it's called terminal operation. So there's the end count or to list or whatever. And if I call to list or count, then behind the scenes, the iterator is called indirectly, or a splitterator goes to collection and partitions the collections into, depending on some heuristics. And it can be multi-threaded or single-threaded, depending what you are doing. And there's lots of magic behind the scenes, actually, right? So this is actually one of the most complex stuff in Java, I would say, right?
It's pretty complex, yeah. And so if you... It's not, you know, it's one of those things. It's like, it's magic until you understand it. And it is a little hard to understand, but it's not that hard to understand. But I think, and I give Brian a lot of credit for this. because he came up with a splitterator concept and he refined it over several, you know, there were several cycles of evolution of the splitterator. And I think he finally ended up, and this was mainly implementation concerns. Mm-hmm. But it's also a marriage of implementation concerns and what it would take to implement a splitterator. Mm-hmm. So if you have a collection, implementing a splitterator is not that hard, but you do have to understand a fair amount of stuff in order to do it effectively. Mm-hmm. But it is a little weird because a splitterator can be run in sort of iterative mode where you can just say, get me the next element. Mm-hmm. Or in fact, process all the remaining elements with this lambda. So that's a for each remaining. Mm-hmm. But then there's also this wrinkle in there, which is you can ask a splitterator to split itself. Mm-hmm. And it's very strange. It's a little strange because I always forget which half is returned. But suppose you have a splitterator S1 and you say S1.split. Mm-hmm. So the semantics are as close as possible, half S1 mutates itself so that it represents only half of the original elements, and mm-hmm. then it returns a new splitterator S2 that represents the other half. And I always have to revisit this. I always forget which is which. Which of S1 and S2 is on the right or the left?
Today, we would maybe return two iterators and make the old useless, right? To be immutable.
Well, you know, it's an interesting design decision. I actually don't know why Brian did it that way. I think it was to, I don't know, but I can guess. And one of the things is, and it's a very pragmatic implementation reason. From a functional programming standpoint, you'd say, oh, that's ridiculous. You should say S1.split and it should return S2 and S3. Mm-hmm. Which each represent half. And that's arguably a cleaner way to represent it in an API. But in order to do that, you have to return two things, which means you need to return an aggregate, which means you need to allocate memory. Plus, you need to allocate a new splitterator. And actually, Brian did a bunch of the implementation here. And if I recall correctly, this is a bit of a guess, but I think it is operating. I think it is close to the truth, which is, When you're writing parallel programs, inevitably there is a certain amount of setup you have to do before you can actually start to run things in parallel. Mm-hmm. And what you need to do is to drive the amount of single-threaded setup code to an absolute minimum so that you can get to the parallel stuff as quickly as possible. Mm-hmm. And this is Amdahl's law, if you're familiar with that. It's a simple proportion. But, you know, if you had an infinite number of processors, but, you know, let's see. I mean, so we don't have visuals here, so I'll try to hand wave this. Suppose
as soon as possible, you have to distribute the work, right? This is the point.
Yeah. Well, so the thing is, if you have some setup code that takes a certain amount of time,
yeah,
no matter how many processors you have, if you could apply an infinite speed up to the parallel portion, the single threaded portion will dominate.
Exactly.
And so in order to get as most throughput as possible, you need to absolutely minimize the amount of single threaded stuff. So mm-hmm. I think that's why splitterator is why it is, right? So if you allocate more memory, it just means more work to do before getting to the parallel stuff. Because what happens is that the splitting of splitterators occurs during the setup processing before parallel. Mm-hmm. Parallel stuff kicks in. Yeah, so basically I think the easiest way to think about this is an array, right? If you have an array of elements, you can process them one at a time left to right. Or you can say, I have a splitterator that represents I have a splitterator that represents all the elements. And so what happens is the stream framework says, I have n processors that I want to try to keep busy. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to call split on the splitterators until I get about, I think it's 2n or 4n splitterators. The reason it's split, it kind of oversplits. The reason is to try to smooth out lumpiness in the data. Mm-hmm. But basically, so as part of the setup process, the stream framework calls split a bunch of times. And the responsibility of the splitterator isn't that hard, right? All you have to do is say, I'm a splitterator that represents a subrange of an array. Mm-hmm. And I get called split. I have split called on me. And I say, oh, okay, just divide it in half and, you know, return a new splitterator that represents that half and adjust myself so that I represent the first half. Mm-hmm. And then if you only have one element, you return null or something like that. There's some way to say, oh, sorry, I can't mm-hmm. split. Mm-hmm. So conceptually, it's actually not that bad. So or it's not that difficult, right? So the streams framework calls split a bunch of times on the splitterators. And then from the splitterators, it dumps those into a fork join pool as task. It, mm-hmm. it wraps tasks around them and dumps them into a fork join pool. Mm-hmm. And then the fork join pool does its work.
Yeah. And there's a characteristics which returns an int, also interesting, with all that distinct, sorted, sized, and non-null, immutable and concurrent, and subsized. So lots of characteristics going on. And yeah. So you can specify the behavior or suggest the behavior of the splitterator.
Yeah, and it's interesting because I think it's one of those things where this this goes back to, this is kind of a comment on our new release model versus the old release model. In the old release model, we had a few years to develop stuff, and we weren't necessarily able to prove out all the ideas. And I think the stream or the splitterator characteristics are an example of that, because most of those, in retrospect, I'm of the opinion that most of those splitterator characteristics are not useful. Mm-hmm. Some of them enable some optimizations, but the optimizations are so narrow that it's not worthwhile. So, for instance, sorted is an interesting one. Mm-hmm. I think the only optimization is if you have a stream pipeline and you put a sort operator, a sorted operator, in the middle of that stream pipeline, it checks the splitterator and says, oh, if it's sorted, I don't have to do anything. Mm-hmm. But, how often does that happen, right? Mm-hmm. So, however, there are, and this is Brian again. I know Brian has said this repeatedly. The sized and subsized options really do enable the most important optimization of all, mm-hmm. which is the ability to avoid creating temporary or intermediate storage. Mm-hmm. So for instance, suppose you have an array list. An array list has its collections, array list has its elements in an array. And so it knows exactly how many of them there are, mm-hmm. right? And furthermore, and so that's what sized means. And subsized is interesting, which is if you take an array list's splitterator and split it, it mm-hmm. knows exactly how large each split is, right? So if you have, if you have 100 elements and you call split, you get 50 in each split side, right? And so you might say, well, how can you not know? And so I think the typical counter example of that is like a hash set. So a hash set hashes things into buckets in an array. Mm-hmm. And so you know how big the array is, but you don't know how the elements are distributed within that array. And so if you split the array in half, you actually don't know how many are in each half, because you don't know how many, you don't know how the buckets are populated. Mm-hmm. So a hash set is sized but not subsized. So that's the difference there. Okay, so let's go back to array lists. So subsized is really important because there are a lot of. I think it is a fairly
what
common,
what you said right now. Hash set is that the hash set is an array. It's a hash of arrays, and you only don't know how long the arrays within each buckets are. Right? This is you could calculate them, but it's not. But it will cost time, so you just don't know it.
Yeah. So hash set is implemented using hash map, which implements its main table as an array, mm-hmm. but each array slot is a bucket, which might have 0, 1 or more elements. And if there's more than one element, they're in a linked list.
Yeah, and there is no way to efficiently ask how big are you, and this is, or it will be right. inefficient. And
So if you split the array in half, which is kind of the obvious thing to do, you don't know how many are in each side, and you could go count, but that might take you a long time.
Exactly. Then it's,
so it doesn't do that. Yeah. Okay. So subsized is important because, okay, so back to array lists, right? So if you split an array subrange, then you know each split also knows its exact size.
Mm-hmm.
And that's pretty important because there are a lot of things where suppose you have an array list and you you say array list dot stream dot map something 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 dot to list.
Mm-hmm.
So what to list does under the covers is it says, oh, all right, well, I'm going to ask my split iterator what characteristics it has. And it says, oh, it's sized. And not only that, it's subsized. So I know exactly how large a destination array to create.
Mm-hmm.
So that's good. So if I have 100 elements in my array list, I know the resulting list.
Mm-hmm.
And the resulting list is going to wrap an array. So it creates an array of 100 elements. And then every split knows exactly how big it is and also where it goes in the destination array. So if you have a split that takes elements 35 through 47 of the source array, the results from the map operation are going to go into elements 35 to 47 of the destination array.
Mm-hmm.
You can imagine that conceptually it'd be easy to say, okay, an element is created and, you know, passed to each element in the stream pipeline and then deposited somewhere, and at the end the splits are merged. But if you have a splitterator source that is subsized, then you can skip the whole merging operation because the operations deposit the results directly into the destination.
So what means is it is no merge, but you are asking the partitions to get the elements, right? So it's like per reference. So you're asking the first partition, the second, the third, the fourth, instead of merging, right? This is why subsize is used as optimization, so you don't have to merge.
Yeah. So I guess the way I would say it is that each of the tasks, there's enough information for each task to know how to store its results directly into the results array. So there's no no excess copying that's done.
Ah, okay. So it's not like they copy in the right place in advance without merging, right? So this is the difference.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. So in the general case, you would have a task that allocates temporary storage for the number of elements that it processes and then writes into there.
Mm-hmm.
And then there's a merge step that copies those elements into the final destination.
Mm-hmm.
And so that step is skipped if your split iterator is sized and subsized.
Which means?
So anyway, of all the characteristics...
But what means, Stuart, that we should pick the right collection, which is subsized at the beginning, so we get better performance.
Right. Yeah. And so, things that are array-based are that way, right? So a list from list.of, or an array list, or a plain array. If you create a stream from an array, then that will also be sized and subsized.
Linked list? No.
No.
So what means actually, try to avoid linked lists, right?
Possible. I mean, yet another reason not to use linked list.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, interesting one. I never thought about this. So now it's obvious. But you don't like linked lists, seems like.
Yeah. It's kind of, there's a whole history. There's a whole history about linked lists. A lot of misinformation out there over the years. I don't know if we covered linked list in, I don't think so. I was going to say, I was musing to myself whether Morris Naftalin and I covered this in the second edition of the Java Generics and Collections book. I don't think we did, or we might have touched on it briefly. I did do a fair amount of coaching with José Pomard, who wrote within the past year or two, wrote a fairly lengthy array list versus linked list article.
Mm-hmm.
And you can find that on It's either on dev.java or inside.java. I can dig up the link for you.
Yes. So this is interesting. But I thought the entire time about that. So it is actually, we could have stream just with an iterator, which returns a splitterator without collections, right? So I could read from a socket or whatever. And it could implement stream operations without having a collection, actually. This should work. Right. As long as the splitterator gets something, you know, then it would work.
Yes. Well, and there are examples of that. Like buffered reader is an example of that.
If you have a
buffered reader that wraps a socket or a file or something like that, mm-hmm. you can ask it for a stream of you can ask it for its lines, and it returns you a stream of lines.
Mm-hmm. There's files string lines, right? As well.
I think so.
String actually, returns lines, I think. There's a lines method, and this is a
right.
Yeah. So I'm pretty sure because
let
it's
see
a,
if I got that.
This right is very useful there. With multi-line strings. This because
yes.
it yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, so all of those are true. Yeah, so there are a bunch of sources for streams that are not collections.
Yeah, you are right. This is string is the best example because string is not a collection like Java Util Connection. This is collection of characters, but not like collection framework. And they're multi-line string. It's interesting. With lines, you get the lines. Of a string. Uh huh. And this is, I already know the answer. So we cannot have reactive streams, like, so we cannot, you know, endless streams. So if we, for instance, we could read endlessly from a socket.
Well, okay. So the Java 8 streams concept does support infinite streams,
mm-hmm.
but I would not say that that it supports reactive streams.
Mm-hmm.
I actually don't know that much about reactive streams.
Infinite streams is like stream generate and you put a random number so you get the endless stream, so it will never end.
Right. Or you can get a random from Java Util random, you can get various streams of ints, longs and doubles.
Yeah, system main or whatever.
Yeah. Or I think those can those be infinite or I think there are various overloads of those. You can say, I want 100 random numbers, and it dumps them into a stream.
But you're right. I was actually, it was stupid sentence for me, because you can do is stream generate and just pass whatever. You can surround socket with whatever produces, you know, bytes, and then you have it. There's this infinite pointer to a socket, which will, you know, because, but you have to do something with it, right? Okay. If the socket blocks, we are done. Basically, we can say to list is problematic, but the problem is, right? It will wait until it completes, so nothing will happen.
Yeah. So, if you, I mean, suppose you did this, right? Suppose you had a socket and you wrapped a reader around it and then a mm-hmm. buffered reader and then lines and then said to list.
Mm-hmm.
Well, that would read every line from the socket. And so if there was no data available in the socket, but the socket was still open, it would just block.
Exactly.
But yes, it would accumulate an arbitrary number of lines, which might fill up your available memory.
Mm-hmm.
Or, and I think the reason that people might do that is they expect that, well, whoever's at the other end is going to send a finite but unknown amount of data. And then when the connection is closed, then we're going to get a nice list of strings out of our...
But the connection has to be closed. And it would be cool. This is what I meant, is if you could just, you know, have a stream with just maps, filters, and whatever on the fly without waiting until it's closed, you know?
It's interesting. I think there... I don't think that's supported out of the box by Java streams.
If instead of to list, you do for each, would it work?
That's a good question. If you were willing to process them one at a time,
mm-hmm.
then sure. I guess the question is, I mean, people have asked for things like batching and whatnot. And so there's nothing directly in the Streams framework that does that. You can write your own splitterator that does some things, but the question is, you know, what are your batching criteria? Mm-hmm. Right. So like, suppose you're reading stuff off a socket.
I mean, it comes over and over again, right? So if you do something with stuff like Kafka, for instance, right? So this is something similar. You get endless streams of messages, and Kafka has a Java 8 stream-like API, which is declarative. Mm-hmm. And what they just do, they say, okay, read from here and store there, and this is or join or whatever. And or if you are doing something like I would say ChatGPT like, right? So it's, you get also a stream of characters, and it would like to draw the characters in terminal. And of course, what you usually do, you know, threads and just write whatever. But I sometimes really think about it and say, actually, streams should also work. To list is problematic, but maybe for each.
Yeah.
And it could be actually a nice abstraction, because with stream, I could say, I get the character. I could, you know, convert with map or filter out characters I'm not interested in, and just like transformation pipeline. Not necessary. I'm not necessarily interested in a collection. Maybe I'm reading character by character and doing something with it, like a pipeline.
Yeah, that's true. I think one of the difficulties is, even if you did something like for each, then the, you know, for simple things, if all for each does is append to some terminal buffer or something like that, mm-hmm. sure, that's fine. But my hunch is that you will, sooner or later, you will want to demarcate your batches.
Mm-hmm.
And it, obviously, it depends on what the application is.
Mm-hmm.
One typical thing is that you want to read stuff and build up a batch and then hand that batch off so that you can process it all in parallel.
Mm-hmm.
But you don't want to, you know, you don't want to block and then read three lines and then say, okay, I'm going to hand this off to 16 cores to handle three lines in parallel. That's not
not cores. What I thought about right now is terminal applications, right? So I'm building a small Java utility and I'm receiving data from somewhere, and I'm writing to terminal or to file or both, or I don't know.
Yeah.
Very simple thing. It doesn't have to be high performance multi-core application. It could be
a simple
utility. And I thought this just, you know, simple utility stuff, never, you know, application servers, whatever. It's just an okay. It would be a nice abstraction, because map is nice. There are lots of now of mappers, filters, and you can pass a method. So the abstraction is right. And as long as, you know, you have the collection, then you can, you know, you can transform to another collection. But if the collection is alive, so it, you know, it lives and provides data on the fly, then it doesn't work anymore.
Yeah, that would work.
Okay, so I will experiment with it, because collections. So we actually covered, surprisingly, also the internals of streams.
Mm-hmm.
Are well covered, right?
I think so. Actually, I did think of a couple key design decisions that your listeners might be interested in. And so one I talked about already, which was whether to use iterable as the extension point or stream as the extension point. And there's a reason for that. And the primary one was that if the streams operations are all lazy,
mm-hmm.
whereas the collections operations are all immediate or eager, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
And so we wanted to keep them separate. So that's why if we put them on iterable, then every collection would have had this, you know, a large number of mixture of methods that were both lazy and eager.
Mm-hmm. You mean if you will put map and everything on iterable, this would have
to right.
Go. Okay.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And in fact, that's what Eclipse Collections did with Rich Iterable, right? So mm-hmm. all of their collection implementations have all of the regular collection methods and the higher order functions, right? And it's just a different design decision. We wanted to organize our APIs differently. Another one which caused a fair amount of controversy is that once you consume a stream, you cannot consume it again.
Enumeration, the name, implies maybe that it could be lazy, right? But iterator. It implies it is eager because iterator, next, give me the next. It is like action based.
I don't think that's true.
Okay. This was my impression.
I think you're reading too much into it. I think the main thing is that, I mean, one of the things we did wrestle with for a long time was, so step one was split the new higher order function, lazy higher order functions off into a new interface called stream. Mm-hmm. Okay. Now that we have, on the one hand, we have collections, and the other hand, we have streams. Okay. So streams have their own mini language API. And so you alluded to them earlier. There are intermediate operations versus terminal operations. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, I think when you're learning streams, you invoke the higher order functions and they're just lazy. So if you just say, you know, if I have a list and say list.stream.map, you get nothing.
Yeah.
Because map is an intermediate operation and nothing happens until you call a terminal operation.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think, you know, we spent a lot of time on that. One of the reasons is that we wanted the work that's actually done. We wanted there to be a concept of a terminal operation so that it could look upstream and choose it can do some optimizations like the sized and subsized operation.
Mm-hmm.
And there, you know, there are different ways to do it. I think Eclipse, Scala, and Kotlin have chosen differently. So if you say stream, if you have list.map, you get a list with all the elements mapped. And I think that's more convenient for people. But if you're not careful, what it does is it ends up creating an intermediate collection for, you know. So if you say, you know, list.map.filter.map or something like that, then we wanted to avoid having to create an intermediate collection for all of those.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's why they're lazy. And so that's why
it's efficiency.
A separate concept of a terminal operation.
Mm-hmm.
But then the other thing is once you've applied a terminal operation once you've applied any operation to a stream. So if you say stream.map, what you get is you get back a new stream. Well, what happens if you save the previous stream and attempt to chain something off of that? Well, you get an illegal state exception or something like that. It says
this stream closed or consumed. Something. Yeah. Yeah.
The stream has been consumed already.
Yeah.
And so that was, I mean, ideally, I mean, it doesn't come up in practice if you write typical stream pipelines, but if you're not careful, sometimes you can get into trouble. What people sometimes
it happens to me sometimes because sometimes I don't like to keep a list. I have the stream, and for instance, in a record, I would like to keep the stream and not the list. And then, of course, I can just use it once, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. And otherwise, I will have to call stream to list, and then we'll have to convert the list to a stream again. But if so, okay, I have the stream already, I can use it later, but I can only use it once. And I don't use it for efficiency. I use it because it's less code. You know, if I have the stream, I don't have to do two lists and then stream again. I just have the stream and I'm careful and it works. So,
Yeah, that's true. So if you're careful, it will work. But I think sometimes people get into trouble when they want to say, okay, I have a stream. I want to do some processing steps. And now I have a stream that represents some interesting set of elements. And I want to process it two different ways.
Exactly.
How come I can't fork the stream?
Yeah.
And the problem is that if you have two stream, if you wanted to add kind of a fork operation in the middle of stream, then now you have two downstream consumers. And there's this big question which arises, which is, what if the downstream consumers consume at different rates?
Mm-hmm.
Somebody has to do some buffering somewhere. And we don't know that they're going to be consuming at different rates. So defensively, we have to do an arbitrary amount of buffering.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. On the other hand, we could say, okay, so if you fork a stream, then henceforth, the downstream consumers run in lockstep. And that's totally at odds with the parallel execution strategy.
Can we fork stream? We cannot, right?
No. And so what we did was we said, okay, so we like the parallel execution model of a straight stream pipeline. Mm-hmm. You know, what I described earlier with splitting and dispatching out to the mm-hmm. join pool. But if you want to put a fork in a stream, the streams framework isn't going to do that for you automatically mm-hmm. because it might require arbitrary buffering. And so we don't want to do that under the covers. Mm-hmm. And so what we say is if you're willing to pay the hit to do buffering, then what you should do is you should dump the stream elements into a list and then get two streams out of that list and process them independently. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So you can fork you can't fork a stream directly, but the way to fork a stream is to create your own intermediate collection. And we wanted that to be explicit in the code. Mm-hmm. So that was one of the
designs. It's interesting talking to you because your angle is efficiency. And my angle first is write simple code first.
Yeah.
And then measure. So we see whether it's fast enough or not, usually. And I have, of course, re-invite you back because we have another topic which we cover a little bit, our fork join pools, of course.
Right.
And there are also some exciting technologies which we didn't cover, our Telex a little bit. Telex was covered. But there is some,
enough of that ancient history.
Yeah. And
unless you wanted to talk about how to delete characters from a paper tape.
we had it last time, I think, with the paper tape. Yeah.
I don't know. Up to you. It's just trivia. Don't worry
about
it.
But no, trivia is great. And the entire podcast is about trivia. And so
that's true.
Yeah. There's lots of fun. I would say I have to, and I'm interested. Maybe we can talk a little bit more about the parallel, because it's not that obvious whether it is always worth or not to call the parallel, and what happens if you do parallel and stream and parallel, and what is the relation to fork join pool? Maybe what is work stealing? You know, there's lots of cliffhangers, and how to configure the because there were hacks in Java E. I don't know whether you remember. You know how to pass the thread pool from application server to a parallel stream.
Right. Yeah. There was some discussion about that, and there's a bunch of issues there. I'm a little I can certainly make some intelligent comments on it. I'm not an expert in that area.
Trivia. In worst case, we will cover.
I think it's a little more than trivia. There are really some serious design considerations.
And in worst case, we will talk about how to delete, the holes from the.
Yes, that's true.
we have enough fallbacks,
Yeah.
Okay.
And don't forget, there's also deprecation.
In Java or in tapes?
In Java.
Okay. I was already curious about the tapes. How to deprecate the holes. No. Okay.
Yeah.
Okay, then thank you. And see you at JFocus, maybe?
No, I'm not going to be at JFocus, but I will be at Java 1. I hope. I think I saw you at Java 1 last year. Maybe I'll see you.
Yeah, I'm Java 1 as well. I'm looking forward to the conference.
So, great.
Yeah. And last time was great. I'm really curious, a little bit afraid of this one because it cannot be improved anymore. So this, I'm really curious.
Yeah.
Last year was great.
Yeah. So I'm looking forward to it. We're going to do our best to make it as good as we can. So, so looking forward to seeing you in March.
Yeah.
At Java 1.
See you there.
Okay. Great. Talk to you again.
Bye.
Bye-bye.